With much of middle-class America still feeling the sting of the housing market collapse, a newly proposed law is aimed at helping homeowners who can't qualify for mortgage refinancing. Supporters of the legislation say it could allow many people to save up to $500 a month on their mortgages. NPR's Chris Arnold has more.
Lawmakers think that they can refinance millions of homeowners, save each of them thousands of dollars a year. And the most attractive thing, they say this actually won't cost taxpayers any money. The vehicle for pulling that off, they say, is today's low interest rates.
Attention mortgage shoppers. Rates are at 50-year lows. Mortgage rates have been below 4.875 all year.
Mortgage rates just hit another record low this past week. So if homeowners can refinance these days, they can often save a bunch of money. The problem is that millions of people cannot qualify to refinance. Many are underwater, meaning they owe more than their house is worth, or they have bad credit, or they've lost some income. So this new proposal is to let those people take advantage of the low rates.
This is a market-based solution.
That's Democratic Congressman Dennis Cardoza of California. He introduced the bill this past week. He explains that the vast majority of home loans out there are already guaranteed by the federal government, many through the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
The federal government is already on the hook for everyone who defaults on these mortgages, 37 million American mortgages.
Cardoza says a massive refinancing of these loans at today's lower market rates would make these loans more affordable for people. That would put money in their pockets to go out and spend and stimulate the economy. And all these people need is for the government to say it will guarantee the more affordable loan. So basically, the government would be swapping out its guarantee from a more expensive loan and applying it to one with lower payments, one that's less likely to default and go into foreclosure.
It would allow people to use the market to refinance so they get lower interest rates on their current home mortgages.
Still, some economists aren't so crazy about the idea. Anthony Sanders is a real estate finance professor at George Mason University.
I think the government should back away because everything they've tried with good intent has not worked.
Sanders doesn't believe that the program wouldn't cost any money, and he worries about unintended consequences. Maybe refinancing all these people would hurt banks or other investors, such as pension funds. They wouldn't be getting those higher interest rate payments anymore. And Sanders thinks that the government has just done too much already to try to prop up the housing market.
Why are we absolutely dead set on keeping housing prices artificially high? I think it's unfair to people trying to get into the market.
Still, Congressman Cardoza didn't exactly dream up this plan himself, and it's not something that just appeals to Democrats. The proposal actually comes from a pair of economists at Columbia University, one of whom is Glenn Hubbard, the former head of President George W. Bush's economic team.
Well, I don't even view this as an intervention in the way we've done before.
Hubbard says the government would not be taking on any more risk or bailing people out with a subsidy. And Hubbard, again a Republican, thinks that there could be solid bipartisan support.
I would guess that there's a good chance of that. We're talking about 37 million homeowners. So I think, yes, there should be.
Are you having specific conversations with people on both sides of the aisle in Congress or the Senate right now? Or?
Yes.
Bipartisan cooperation before the elections is probably unlikely, but Hubbard thinks that after the elections, this proposal could get some traction. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
There may be no better example of how the faltering economy affects the everyday life of low-income families than a Walmart store on the last night of the month. There at around 11 p.m., families load up on necessities like diapers and groceries. And then, as the clock ticks into the new month, they check out using government funds just deposited into their accounts. NPR's Jamie Terabay traveled to a 24-hour Walmart in Fredericksburg, Virginia, filed this report.
Tracy and Martin Young are in their early 30s. They're in track pants, and each has pushed a shopping cart overflowing with food to the checkout counter. Mac and cheese, bags of cereal, drink mixes, and cans of evaporated milk.
Instead of using regular milk, because it blends better with the cheese. when you put for the macaroni and cheese.
There's torrential rain outside. There are flash flood warnings across the area, and yet they're here, shopping. Tracy says they've been doing this midnight run on the last day of every month for so long now. They're on a first-name basis with Gloria, their cashier.
It's been about a year. We used to go to Bloom, and then we found out we were saving more coming here.
At a stroke or two after midnight, they begin unloading their shopping carts at the checkout. Tracy says they set aside $500 for groceries a month. They have five kids, and the money they get never lasts until the next monthly check.
It's usually a week and a half, right, Martin? What? Like when we run out, like when we try to figure out what we need to do, about a week and a half before the end of the month.
Tracy works in retail, and Martin works two jobs. One of those is as a waiter at a fast food chain, so their monthly income goes up and down all the time. They get food stamps and government assistance for their three-year-old daughter. Tracy says all their income goes to groceries, the rent, the bills, and hardly anything is left over.
There's no question that there's going to be more people living paycheck to paycheck now.
Heidi Scherholtz is a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute. She says many families are on the brink of poverty.
They see wages get cut or not grow at all. So family incomes really suffer. And when family incomes take a hit, some fall down.
Last year, 3.7 million Americans joined those already living in poverty, meaning families of four living on just under $22,000. That's 14% of the population. The government says the price of food has risen in the last year. Eggs are 44% more. Milk is up 21%, mainly because of fuel prices. Walmart noticed that sales were spiking on the first of every month. In a recent conference call with investment analysts, Walmart executive Bill Simon said these midnight shoppers provide a snapshot of the American economy today.
And if you really think about it, the only reason somebody gets out in the middle of the night and buys baby formula is that they need it and they've been waiting for it. Otherwise, you know, we're open 24 hours, come at 5 a.m., come at 7 a.m., come at 10 a.m. But if you're there at midnight, you're there for a reason.
And so Walmart has changed its stocking patterns. It brings out larger packs of items in the beginning of the month and smaller sizes towards the end. It makes sure shelves have plenty of diapers and formula.
It's definitely an indicator in terms of people who are struggling.
Charles Fishman is a journalist and the author of The Walmart Effect.
And that tells you that there's a large swath of America that is still very carefully calculating how much money is available and how they're spending it, even on the most basic things like diapers and milk and bread. And that's not the sign of an economy that has shaken off the recession.
At the checkout, Tracy and Martin Young see the total.
How much is it?
$485.49.
Is that under budget?
Yeah. About like, what, 60?
So what are you going to spend that 60 on?
Oh, we'll probably go, you know, get some canned stuff from somewhere else, you know, where it's like 65 cents a can. So that way we got canned vegetables all through the house. We never run out of nothing.
Tracy says their children know when the end of the month is approaching because what they like to eat is gone and the kitchen shelves have emptied. The children are all home asleep while the parents are out shopping. In the morning, Tracy says, they'll wake up and be able to have what they want for breakfast. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
We used to call Ireland the Celtic Tiger because of its roaring economy. But times have changed. Yesterday, Ireland's central bank revealed that bailing out the country's many troubled banks could ultimately cost as much as $68 billion. That number stunned and appalled the Irish, as NPR's Philip Reeves found out when he took to the streets of Dublin.
Take a dollar, feed it into a slot machine, put another dollar in. In fact, put a dollar in every second, every hour, every day, and keep going. At that rate, it would take you more than 2,000 years to cover the debts run up by Ireland's banks. They're roughly equivalent to one-third of Ireland's entire annual GDP, a breathtaking sum just too big for most of us to grasp.
You know, in historic terms, it's actually very hard to find parallels.
Fintan O'Toole is a columnist for the Irish Times. He says the Irish have known for a long time the situation's bad.
Actually having the figures coming directly from governments and having them confirmed is still really shocking. And I think there is a sense of being disgusted, but also being stunned and very scared.
One bank, the Anglo-Irish, is responsible for the biggest chunk of these debts, up to $47 billion. Business journalist John McManus says that's a massive amount for a country with a population of just 4.5 million.
If you scale that up to the American economy, that would be a $2 trillion bank failure, which would even the American economy would probably have trouble swallowing that.
The Irish are certainly having trouble swallowing this. The government's preparing a 4-year austerity programme to try to drastically shrink the deficit, currently running at an unprecedented 32% of GDP. Higher taxes and heavy public spending cuts are a certainty. On the streets of Dublin today, the anger's palpable. Eamon Lawler drives a cab.
We were booming for the last 20 years, and now all of a sudden we find ourselves in a situation where generation after generation will be paying back the money because of the banks, and the government have done absolutely nothing.
Lawler says it's becoming very hard to find work.
I have two daughters. One has emigrated because she's a teacher, just qualified as a teacher, and has had to emigrate to Australia.
Close by, on Dublin's fashionable Grafton Street, people wander in and out of the boutiques and cafes like any other day. But stallholder John Kelly says there's a lot of anger under the surface.
It's like a burning fuse. There's an immense amount of anger in society. Something like a third of people are worried about their job security. The anger is out there.
A few yards away, Anne O'Reilly is preparing for a job interview. She's 22 and recently completed an engineering degree. With the collapse of Ireland's construction boom, O'Reilly's decided to lower her expectations and try for an administrative job.
It's pretty bad, I guess, especially for young people. You know, maybe when we started our college courses maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it was probably at the height of the boom. And then obviously when you come out at the end of it, it's sort of a different story. And it's, you know, disheartening after all that hard work and everything. You know, you have all these young, bright, young, enthusiastic people looking for jobs.
Alex, a drinker in a downtown pub today, is neither young nor enthusiastic. He's 65 and unemployed. He won't give his full name. He says this is because he's a thief, and adds,
"But I won't. I don't mug people or anything like that. Shops.
So you just look out for an opportunity and then...
Yeah, I just take it, you know, and if I'm caught, I'm caught."
Alex says he's ashamed of his stealing. He says he steals because he has no hope of a job and can't afford to live and booze on welfare. Now, as his government prepares to hand over vast sums of public money to Ireland's reckless bankers, Alex says he finally knows what it feels like to be robbed. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Dublin.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Inside Job, that's the title of a new documentary about the global economic crisis of 2008 that led to global recession. The film is a searing look at the financial industry, the big players, and the culture that led to the meltdown.
We deal with type A personalities, and type A personalities know everything in the world.
Banking became a pissing contest. No, mine's bigger than yours, that kind of stuff. It was all men that ran it, incidentally.
$50 billion deals were not large enough, so we do $100 billion deals.
That's just a taste of the candid commentary elicited from Wall Street insiders and experts by filmmaker Charles Ferguson. His last documentary, titled No End in Sight, about the Iraq War, was nominated for an Oscar. I asked Ferguson what his assumptions were when he started making Inside Job.
By the time I decided to make the film, which was after the world came to the edge of collapse in September 2008, by that time I already realized that there had been a fair amount of bad behavior in the financial industry, so I thought that I was prepared. It turned out, however, that I wasn't. I had grossly underestimated the level of extraordinarily unethical and even fraudulent behavior that had occurred on such a large scale, and was really quite shocked when I found it.
Interesting to me that you say you were shocked, because this is well-trampled ground by now in books and in magazine articles and on this radio program about just what led up to the meltdown. What were the revelations for you?
I started doing research for the film in the fall of 2008, and when we were already filming in the middle of 2009, the world first learned, and we were among the first to learn, actually, that not only had the investment banks been creating and selling securities that they frequently knew were defective and likely to go bad, but they had been, in fact, designing them to go bad so that they could profit by betting against them. And if somebody had told me that in the fall of 2008, that this had gone on a huge scale, tens of billions of dollars, I would have said, no, that's just too extreme. People don't do that. And if you do it, you would go to jail. They did do it, and nobody's gone to jail.
You include a scene from a Senate hearing where Senator Carl Levin is interrogating some of the top executives of Goldman Sachs about, well, is this ethical? Do you have a problem with this?
Yes. And this is after Senator Levin has read from memos in which people describe deals as being crappy and so on. Their answers are extremely dispiriting.
And when you heard that your employees in these emails and looking at these deals said, God, what a deal. God, what a piece of crap. Do you feel anything?
I think that's very unfortunate to have on email.
Are you embarrassed?
And very unfortunate. I don't.
On email,
please don't take that.
How about feeling that way?
I think it's very unfortunate for anyone to have said that in any form.
Is it your understanding? Not unfortunate as in unethical or disastrous, or it's really a quite extraordinary hearing.
You make some claims toward the end of the film that have to do with academia, with people at institutions of higher learning, and your claim is that the financial industry has corrupted the study of economics itself. What do you mean by that?
What you find is that very prominent professors of economics, often people who have also held high government posts, are paid to testify in Congress. They are paid to be expert witnesses in both civil and criminal trials. They're often paid to write papers that praise the financial services industry and argue on behalf of deregulation of the industry. They make millions, in some cases tens of millions of dollars doing this. And this is usually not disclosed. And in fact, university regulations do not require disclosure of these payments.
You include an exchange that gets increasingly angry with Glenn Hubbard. He was the chief economic advisor to President George W. Bush. He's now dean of Columbia Business School. And you're asking him about this outside income that you're talking about, the income he gets from being on the boards of companies in the financial services industry. And it leads up to this. Let me play you this bit of tape.
Do they include other financial services firms?
Possibly.
You don't remember?
This isn't a deposition, sir. I was polite enough to give you time. Foolishly, I now see. But you have three more minutes. Give it your best shot.
Charles Ferguson, tell me about that moment in Glenn Hubbard's office.
Well, the entire interview was fairly contentious, as you can imagine. It surprised me somewhat to realize that these people were not used to being challenged, that they'd never been questioned about this issue before. They clearly expected to be deferred to by me and I think by everybody.
I've not been invited back, safe to say, to Glenn Hubbard's office.
No, I think it'll be quite a long time before I have lunch with Glenn Hubbard.
Charles Ferguson, you make it very clear in your movie that you want accountability. In fact, you want people locked up for criminal activity. Who would you want to see put in jail?
Well, at the level of individuals, that's for a judicial proceeding to decide. But I think the important point is that in prior financial crises caused by large-scale fraud, for example, the late 1980s savings and loan crisis, financial executives were prosecuted and imprisoned. And in this crisis, where it's clear that large-scale fraud has occurred, it's extremely alarming and depressing that there has not been a single criminal prosecution.
Well, if you look at the one prosecution that there has been, a high-profile prosecution of the two Bear Stearns hedge fund managers on fraud, they were both acquitted, and acquitted very quickly by a jury in New York. And people looking at that case say it's not so easy to make these cases.
Well, it depends how hard you try. First of all, they were, by investment banking standards, not terribly high-level executives. There has not been a single prosecution of a senior financial services executive, either in investment or commercial banking. Secondly, that prosecution shows several things about the weakness of the government's efforts and the role of the economics discipline. One reason that they were acquitted was that Glenn Hubbard was paid $100,000 to testify in their defense. It's a very common thing for professors of economics to testify as expert witnesses in both civil and criminal cases. And it's also very dispiriting that the government has not chosen to use the same tools that it routinely uses when it's prosecuting organized crime cases. When the government goes after organized crime cases, the government is frequently quite ruthless and understandably so in obtaining evidence. And so that kind of energy and determination has been completely absent with regard to the financial crisis.
Do you think, though, there are legal experts who say, who look at these cases and say, it may be that the law wasn't broken, that the companies and institutions used existing laws to their benefit? We may not like the way they did it, but the laws were not broken.
Well, in some cases, that's probably true, and the laws should be fixed, which has not been the case. But more importantly, as a practical matter, it's impossible to do what they did without committing criminal fraud. And so I think that it's overwhelmingly likely that large quantities of criminal fraud were committed.
Charles Ferguson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Charles Ferguson's documentary, opening next week in New York and around the country after that, is titled Inside Job.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.